The time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Monday, April 1st, 2024. I'm your host, Rachel Fields.
And I'm your host, Sam Swartz. In tonight's news,
a proposed amendment to city ordinances looks to prevent repeat dog attacks.
Wisconsin has joined a new federal program that will feed school kids in need during the summer months.
A professor with UW-Madison School of Education shares his perspective on this year's FAFSA delays.
And in the second half, the government's calendar for the week ahead, the anniversary of a boss napping, the details on a popular cocktail, and two movie reviews. This is Sam Swartz and Rachel Fields with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Here are your headlines tonight.
The Wisconsin Election Commission announced today that they had received a petition from the, quote, No Labels political party to appear on the general election ballot for president in November. The new political party is focused on centrism and bipartisanship, but has not yet announced the planned party nominee for president. The petition deadline was today, and the Wisconsin Election Commission said that No Labels had included nearly 27,000 signatures, although the commission had not yet verified them. Individuals who wish to challenge the sufficiency of the petition have a 10-day deadline to do so. The Wisconsin Election Commission plans to make the petition available on their website.
Governor Tony Evers vetoed 41 bills last Friday, in addition to signing a few bills into law, reports the Associated Press. Bills that are now laws include a measure to support education on the Holocaust and a bill to increase the number of mental health crisis centers in Wisconsin. Among the many bills vetoed by the governor was a tax cut that would have cost the state $3.2 billion over the next 2 years, which Evers said would have left the state unable to provide basic services. Evers also vetoed a bill targeting diversity statements at institutions of higher learning and a bill that would require the Department of Natural Resources to set a hard number for its target for wolf populations in the state. Evers has vetoed more bills than any other governor in Wisconsin history.
Governor Evers signed a bill into law that would expand the definition of repeat offenders for the purposes of the state's sex offender registry and GPS tracking system, reports the Capital Times. Previously, a person would have to be convicted in separate occasions to be considered a repeat offender, whereas now there just need to be multiple charges, even if they stem from the same incident. People who are determined to be repeat sex offenders can be put on GPS monitoring indefinitely, with no possibility of appeal or judicial review, and are charged $200 a month to pay for their own monitoring.
Union members at a city brewing company plant in La Crosse voted last week to authorize a strike amid ongoing contract negotiations at the plant, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The company is trying to shift the plant to a 24/7 operation schedule, which would require workers to work 12-hour shifts, a move that union members voted overwhelmingly to reject. The union says they hope the company will choose to hire new workers rather than expand the shifts of current employees. The current contract is set to expire May 8th. If new contracts are not agreed on before then, members have now authorized the union to go on strike.
The University of Wisconsin-Madison has announced a new parental leave policy where full-time employees will receive 6 weeks of paid time off following the birth or adoption of a child, reports the Capital Times. The UW system expects that approximately 1,500 employees will use parental leave in a given year, costing the system just under $500,000 annually. Previously, employees in the UW system had to use their sick and vacation days to take time off for a new child or take an unpaid leave. The new policy is set to go into effect July 1st, pending approval from the Board of Regents.
The Dane County Airport has asked the City of Madison to consider not moving forward with developing low-income housing in a zone of the city that it has determined is likely to experience an average sound level greater than 65 decibels. A noise study commissioned by the airport found that areas in the city that experience high levels of sound pollution are going to expand greatly by 2027, mostly due to the new F-35 fighter jets flying out of the airport, reports the Capital Times. The commission recommends not moving forward with housing development projects in the area, citing concerns of more people living with high levels of noise pollution, which can have detrimental effects on residents' health. The city met the recommendation with skepticism, with the mayor citing the affordable housing crunch as taking priority and calling the commission's recommendation, quote, unrealistic.
The Wisconsin Department of Transportation Division of Motor Vehicles announced today that they will be extending their hours at customer service centers today and tomorrow. The extended hours are to help voters who need a photo identification visit a DMV and acquire one in time to vote for the election tomorrow. People wondering if they have the necessary identification can visit the Wisconsin Election Commission's website to see a list of approved forms of identification. Voters can also obtain a receipt from the DMV that is valid for voting while the paperwork is being filed for an identification and may be able to submit a provisional ballot prior to the arrival of their photo ID. Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Madison's city ordinance does not require dog owners to restrain their pets if they have a bite history, but a severe dog attack now has elected officials looking to change that. WORT News producer Faye Parks has the details.
Bill Leaders is a local journalist and the proud owner of an elderly dog named Stella. Last spring, Stella was attacked by a male pit bull named Roscoe.
Well, it was on May 8th. We were walking our dog when it was attacked by a pit bull that was unchained in its yard. This dog, which is about four times the size of our dog, attacked Stella and hurt her quite badly. We were at the emergency vet clinic until midnight that night, and there was a 3 or 4 week recovery period. She was seriously wounded, and it was a very traumatic and terrifying experience.
That attack left both him and his beloved pet shaken. And for nearly a year, Leaders has been calling for a change to city policy. He says that city policy does little to prevent repeat dog attacks. Roscoe's owners, he says, still don't restrain him on their property.
To this day, that dog is unchained in its yard as a regular thing. Nobody watching it, no chain, no fence, nothing to restrain it, with the neighbors scared to death about, you know, the threat that it poses to their children and their dog.
Current city ordinance states that the Board of Health for Madison and Dane County must investigate reported animal attacks. They can impose a fine of up to $500. In Leader's case last year, Roscoe's owner was fined $341 and paid Stella's $800 emergency vet bill. Alder Tag Evers represents Madison's Near West Side on the Common Council.
Of course, staff has discretion in terms of levying that fine based on severity. If it's, you know, just a nip, doesn't break skin, you know, scares more than hurts. My understanding is that staff often doesn't issue a citation, perhaps just a warning and a suggestion that, you know, take more care in the future.
And in more serious cases, the Board of Health can take further action. After a lengthy process that involves interviewing neighbors and meeting the dog and its owner, the board may issue a dangerous dog designation.
It can become a legal matter because if a dog is severely aggressive, the Board of Health has the option of confiscating that animal. And if nothing can be done to restore the animal to some level of compatibility with an urban environment, a neighborhood environment, the option is to euthanize that dog.
That leaves a gap in Board of Health policy between either a fine, which Evers argues doesn't do enough to control aggressive dogs, or euthanasia, which Evers says is the most extreme option and can lead to litigation. Alder Evers, a friend of Leaders, introduced an ordinance amendment in February that he says would fill that gap in policy. In addition to the possible $500 fine if an animal is aggressive, the Board of Health would also be able to impose measures to prevent another attack.
Staff could require that the owner of the dog place this dog under restrictions when it's on the property. And then off the property, staff would then also be able to order that your dog would have to be muzzled.
The proposed amendment lists what restrictions would be acceptable and explicitly leaves out electric fences. According to Leaders, Roscoe was wearing a shock collar on the day he attacked Stella, and Leaders says the owner claimed that they had neglected to change the batteries.
The people who make these electric fences and electric collars stress that it should never, ever be used for dogs that have a history of aggression. That's not what it's for.
The proposed change is coming before the Board of Health, which is scheduled to consider it at their meeting this Wednesday at 5:30. The amendment will come back to the full Common Council later this April. If approved by the city, The change would also have an additional hurdle to clear, the Dane County Board. That's because it would be a policy change affecting the Board of Health, which is a joint city-county board. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
During the pandemic, school-aged children received free access to free meals through the federal government, including the summer months. That support eventually expired, but many states are now taking advantage of a similar program geared toward feeding kids when school is out. Wisconsin has been approved for a launch in the coming months, and Mike Moen of Wisconsin News Connection has the story.
Wisconsin children from low-income families are now on track to get nutritious foods over the summer. Federal officials have approved the Badger State's plan to join a new program that includes dozens of other states. Governor Tony Evers says Wisconsin is the first state to get the green light for the summer electronic benefit transfer program. 36 other states are poised to launch this summer, too. Eligible households will receive preloaded debit cards that families can use to buy groceries. Shelley Fortner of the Hunger Task Force of La Crosse applauds the move, noting half of the kids in the local school district already qualify for free and reduced price lunches during school.
We've got families with low incomes, most of them working, by the way, but just not able to put that extra meal on the table for kids who are at home during the summer months.
This new permanent program, authorized by Congress, is similar to the enhanced meal access the federal government provided during the pandemic. Throughout Wisconsin, there are separate meal sites for these kids when school isn't in session, but supporters of the new effort say it provides more flexibility, especially for households with limited transportation options. State officials point out that most families already enrolled in the National School Lunch Program will automatically receive the summer benefits. Fortner says meal access aids kids in their learning. For the summer, she says the additional access will help keep them active.
We've had a lot of information about, you know, sedentary activities like video games and TV and all of that. But our kids are now getting outdoors more, and they need to have that energy to be able to keep that up.
She adds this should help foster healthy lifelong habits for kids and prevent them from starting the next school year feeling sluggish. For each eligible child, the state will provide a one-time summer benefit of $120. Anticipated the money will be available in late June. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
This year, the U.S. Department of Education revised their free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA. They say that the new application is more user-friendly and could broaden eligibility for federal aid by more than 600,000 students. But the revised application came out months behind schedule and is rife with technical issues, and admissions offices across the country are still waiting on the information that helps them determine need-based scholarships. According to Wisconsin Public Radio, more than 17 million students fill out the FAFSA each year. As of late March, the Department of Education says they've processed and delivered about 1.5 million applications. Taylor Odell is an assistant professor in UW-Madison School of Education, specializing in educational policy and economics. Earlier today, he shared his perspective with WORT News producer Faye Parks.
Thank you for joining me, Professor Odell.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So to start, can you give us a bit of context? How does the FAFSA application process usually work? What is the timeline?
The whole point of financial aid in higher education is to identify students who are in need of financial support, to have some type of affordability constraint so that colleges and the federal government can target grants and scholarships to them to help them pay for college. And the FAFSA, or the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, is one way that colleges can identify if students are financially needy, if they could use a grant or scholarship to help pay for college. And traditionally, students fill out the FAFSA, or the free application for federal student aid, in the fall or even spring of their senior year. And this allows colleges to receive information on a student's or family's ability to pay for college so that colleges can then package financial aid awards. So you say, hey, Faye, you've been admitted and here is X scholarship or X grant for you to help you pay for college. So as soon as students fill out the FAFSA, colleges can get access to that information to know if they're eligible for awards, et cetera, et cetera. But most students want to do that by the spring of their senior year so that colleges can start packaging award letters And so students can kind of make decisions by April or May. Kind of May 1 is the traditional kind of college decision day when students are expected to kind of respond to institutions to let them know that they want to take them up on that offer of admission or that financial aid award.
This year's process is seeing serious delays. How delayed is it, and what are some of the causes?
We're delayed by many, many months. So some colleges still aren't receiving students' information. We're now in April. So May 1 seems kind of like a pipe dream for many colleges of being able to package awards, get them out to students, and then get responses back from students, because many colleges still aren't receiving information on students' eligibility for federal financial aid, like a Pell Grant, which a college may use to give other types of financial aid or make other decisions on institutional awards. And so the FAFSA has been a very long and complex form that has existed for many, many years and has been relatively stagnant over that time. And so the federal government has taken a very important step to modernizing the FAFSA, to simplifying it in a variety of ways, and making an important change into how it signals students' eligibility or their kind of financial neediness, if you will, moving from something that used to be called the expected family contribution, which used to give kind of a very single number that said Faye's family can pay X dollars per year. Like it might say $10,000 or something. And so a college could use that to determine how much other amount of need-based financial aid, for example, you might need. Well, there's a movement now away from the expected family contribution to something called the Student Aid Index, which is instead an index that kind of clarifies that this is just signaling a student's eligibility for aid, but not specifically saying they can or should pay a specific amount of money. And so this meant that the federal government and the Department of Education needed to change how they calculated that, going from an EFC to an FAI. So it's a revamp of the form. So that kind of caused some potential challenges. There were also technical challenges with students being able to access the new form to the form kind of processing that data. There was a simplification that occurred a couple of years ago called the data retrieval tool, which the idea there was if you and your family have already filed your taxes, you should theoretically be able to link your FAFSA to those tax filings rather than having to go in and say, well, this was my AGI for last year, or this was my income from all sources last year. Kind of just with the kind of typing in your Social Security number, you'd be able to retrieve your prior tax data and link that to kind of fill out most of your FAFSA. Well, there's an issue with the linkage between the Department of Education and the data that was coming over from the IRS. Now there have been some reports that potentially there are some issues with the calculations or considerations for inflation, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of this perfect storm of something definitely needed to happen. Like the FAFSA did need to be updated. This move to Student Aid Index is potentially helpful for institutions and students. But changing a form that 17 or so million people fill out a year is a really complex process. And so, unfortunately, there were technical delays, implementation delays, et cetera, that have occurred that we're kind of pushing up now on the very end of this pipeline of when we hope students would be making their decisions to go to college, to accept letters, et cetera, et cetera. But some colleges still aren't receiving data on whether those students are even eligible for some types of financial aid.
How do these delays impact prospective students, and how might this impact UW-Madison's enrollment next year?
Students and families want to know what financial aid they have available to go to college. And so traditionally, when you fill out your FAFSA, you get almost an immediate, I'm going to say, answer, if you will, that you are eligible for, example, a federal Pell Grant, which can give, you know, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, depending on your family's like financial situation. So you'll know that you're eligible for that almost immediately, and your college will note that again when they send you your financial aid award. But when you file the FAFSA and you apply to an institution, again, as I mentioned, they have access to that information, so they can know if you are in need of other need-based financial aid. They may have a program, you know, like at UW-Madison, like Bucky's Tuition Promise, which is targeted at families who make below a certain financial aid threshold. And so it's a way of directly identifying what that family's income was in the previous year. So then the institution could package and say, hey, you're getting this much in Pell Grant. We're also going to add on Bucky's Tuition Promise, et cetera, for you. So it impacts students and families in that they're not getting information from the federal government on what types of aid they may receive from them, but it's indirectly impacting them because the colleges they're applying to also don't have that information. And so it's hard for colleges and universities to package award letters being kind of completely blind. They don't know who needs money. They don't know how much money each student needs. And they don't know what other types of resources are going to be coming to those students. Are they going to get a Pell Grant? Are they going to get a different type of state aid, et cetera, et cetera? So you're kind of building a budget, missing a lot of pieces of the kind of a lot of the cells or a lot of pieces of the puzzle, if you will. So this makes it hard, I think, for colleges like UW-Madison, but all colleges, to think about how to use their scarce financial aid dollars. If we only have so much money that we can give out, what types of students are we targeting it at?
So my understanding is that UW-Madison has pushed back their decision deadline by about 2 weeks, so from May 1st to May 15th. Do they anticipate this being enough time for the FAFSA issue to be resolved?
So let me just clarify that I don't speak on behalf of UW-Madison and wasn't a part of kind of this decision-making process. But I think most colleges are thinking about doing this for the very same reason, the one you kind of noted, about if we delay, is there a potential that we could get more information on students or get more of the data that we need from the Department of Education that tells us about their financial neediness? Would this allow us to augment or modify financial aid packages? And ultimately, would it give students and families more time to make an informed decision? Does it give them more time to get other financial aid offers, to look at the family finances, to identify what the best mix of grants, scholarships, you know, work study, loans, et cetera, is going to be for them? So I don't think it's so much on the sense of a delay to have more internal processing time as it is a delay to allow students and families to make the best decision for themselves.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Professor Odell.
Yeah, thanks so much. Hope you have a great rest of your day.
That was Taylor Odell, an assistant professor in UW-Madison's School of Education.
Your time right now is 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz, here with my co-host, Rachel Fields. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
It's Monday night. Do you know where your government is and what it's doing? It's time now for our weekly segment, Forward Lookout.
It's Monday, and we're talking to Brenda Conkle about what's happening this week in local government. I'm Faye Parks, filling in for Dylan Brogan, who is unavailable this afternoon. Hi, Brenda.
Good evening, Faye.
Jumping right in, and starting with the city, the Madison Arts Commission met today at noon. Anything of note on their agenda?
They're looking at Madison Metro Phase 2 Percent for Art project. So they are looking at what kind of art they're going to put in that project. And they're also looking at some guidelines for art in the parks.
And then the Equal Opportunities Commission started their executive committee virtual meeting at 5. And that is likely still going. Anything you're keeping an eye on?
Yeah, they usually are working on their agenda for the next full commission meeting, but they are looking at updating some of their ordinances as well as having a community listening session. They had one on March 14th, and so they'll be talking about debriefing that. And then they are looking at some additional community listening meetings.
And then also today, starting at 5:30, was the Sister City Collaboration Committee. So they're in a virtual meeting. What's on the docket?
Usually they hear reports from each of the sister cities, and then they are looking for their quilt that they can't figure out where it has gone. And then they're also going to be looking at a photo exhibit and reception.
Oh, no, not the quilt.
Exactly.
That's no good. Okay, so moving on to the county, the opioid settlement subcommittee started their hybrid meeting at 5. Anything of note there?
They're working on their final recommendations about where they think the funding should go. So there was nothing in that link when I looked at the agenda. So maybe they've added something, or you'll have to attend to find out what they'll be recommending.
And then the county's personnel and finance committee started their hybrid meeting at 5:30 this evening.
Yeah, they have a very, very long agenda. So it's interesting. There's a lot of projects, a lot of affordable housing projects, homelessness funding, and other projects that nonprofits are getting funding. I think they are sort of catching up with last year's budget, and they're sort of getting all the paperwork and contracts and everything in place there. So you'll want to take a look. It's a pretty long list of items. In addition to that, they have some taser replacement. They're going to be looking at transferring some of the criminal justice funds over to the Office of Justice Reform and Equity. They're looking at a manure treatment feasibility study. There's a very long list of things that you might want to take a look at, but there's like funding for their solar project. Where are people going to park while they're building the jail? And then they also have health insurance, some funding for the new election center. They're going to be looking at who they're going to do the architecture and engineering for that. And then they have a grant agreement for the Art House 360.
So moving on to tomorrow, there's nothing on the docket for the county, but the Madison Metro Sewerage District is holding their virtual Employee Leadership Council meeting at 12:30. Anything of note?
No, that's sort of their typical meeting where they go over various requests. The reason why both the city and county have very few meetings is because it's election day. So please don't forget to vote. That's why they cancel meetings when there's local elections.
That makes sense. Absolutely. I thought it looked a little bare. There's logic there.
Right.
And then let's see. So on Wednesday, after Election Day, the Homeless Services Consortium Board of Directors is meeting virtually at 1 p.m. Anything you'll be keeping your eye on?
They have a couple items. It's sort of more internal. So they're looking at their Zoom account. They're looking at having a fiscal sponsor. But they are going to be looking at how they're going to rate applications that come in for some of the federal funding that they get. That's the COC application review, which is our continuum of care application. And that is a joint application the whole community puts in together. But the board actually goes through and determines which projects get ranked higher to determine what gets into that application. The other thing that they're looking at is they're looking at updating some of the written standards that they have for organizations that receive that funding.
And so also on Wednesday, but at 4:30, the Board of Public Works is holding a virtual meeting, and it looks like they have a pretty packed agenda.
They do. One of the things that I noted right away is they have a project where they're asking to make noise either before 7 a.m. or after 7 p.m. at night. And that is going to be along the lakefront underneath John Nolan. So you may want to pay attention to that if you live anywhere in the area. If they're making noise, I'm guessing that that lake is going to carry the noise further than just the immediate area there. And they also have plans and specs that they're doing for several different projects on Starker Avenue, Stevens Street, as well as Hermina and Union Street. And then they are also going to be looking at approving plans and specs for Warner Park Community Recreation Center expansion. And then they also have their 2023 Board of Public Works annual report.
And then at 5:30 on Wednesday, the Board of Health for Madison and Dane County is meeting in the Atrium Community Room at Dane County Human Services. So I know one of their items relates to a story from earlier in our show, an ordinance that would require pet owners to restrain animals in public if they have caused injuries in the past. What else is on their agenda?
They're also going to be looking at the Nurse Family Partnership Program. They're going to be re-upping the contract for that. And then they have a resolution that is going to be an agreement with the Wisconsin Population Health Service Fellowship Program to do some work for them.
And then on Thursday, the Madison Central Business Improvement District is holding a virtual meeting at noon. What's their agenda for that meeting?
Usually they have a whole lot of reports, and so they'll be getting reports from, you know, the alder, from the police, from several of their committees, and then they'll also be getting updates from the city of Madison. So it really is just a bunch of updates.
And so also on Thursday, there are several other meetings with no agendas. So, I can just direct people over to forwardlookout.com. But are there any of those that you think would be interesting, even not knowing what the plan is?
You know, the Police Civilian Oversight Board, their Policy and Procedure Subcommittee, oftentimes they don't have their agendas listed by Monday morning. And so I don't know what's going on there, but I do think that it's worth paying attention to because a lot of people worked really hard to set up this Police Civilian Oversight Board. And I think it's important for us to make sure that that continues to be a success. Other things, the Affirmative Action Commission, Community Development Block Grant, and the Public Library Board also didn't have an agenda, at least as of this morning.
And then for the county on Thursday, there's the Broadband Task Force. They're holding a hybrid meeting at 9 a.m. Then the Library Board is meeting at noon. And then there will be an Executive Committee hybrid meeting at 5:30, then followed by a hybrid meeting of the full county board at 7. So it'll be a pretty busy day for the county. Anything especially notable?
It certainly will. A lot of those items that are on tonight's Personnel and Finance Committee are now going to end up on the county board meeting on Thursday night. Much of what we already talked about will be there for the entire board to talk about.
Brenda Conkle, everybody. If you want to check out this week's meeting agendas for Dane County and Madison, just head to forwardlookout.com. Brenda, we appreciate you taking the time to walk us through this week's calendar.
Thank you so much, Faye.
Yesterday, March 31st, was the anniversary of a boss snapping at a Caterpillar factory in France. In 2009, facing drastic job cuts due to the Great Recession, 40 factory workers stormed their boss's offices and barricaded them inside. Feature contributor Harry Richardson has the story of the sequestrations movement.
For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters, up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered, who struggle brave and long. For the Union men and women, standing up and standing strong.
Yesterday, March 31st, is the anniversary of a boss napping in France in 2009, facing drastic job cuts in the inside. It was part of a wave of actions across France, also called sequestrations, that took corporate heads hostage to get better buyouts payments for the workers. Boss napping has also occurred in New Zealand and China, perhaps inspired by the French. At Caterpillar, the workers took four managers hostage, including Nicolas Poltnik, the chief executive at Caterpillar France, and held them for 24 hours. They demanded a fair severance package as the company gave layoff notices to over 700 of the 2,700 workers in their two factories. Caterpillar was cutting 25,000 jobs worldwide. In the short term, boss napping paid off. As Bloomberg reports, after boss napping, the company upped its total severance package from 48.5 million euros to 50 million euros, amounting to an average of 80,000 euros, $108,000 per worker. The same year, appliance maker Ariston agreed to a severance package of up to 90,000 euros per worker at a Brittany factory, where workers protested layoffs by locking the manager out of the building. The boss napping at Caterpillar was part of a growing wave of direct actions. As The Guardian reported, the Caterpillar crisis was the third in March alone. Other boss nappings took place at U.S. Pharmaceutical Corporation 3M and at Sony France. Boss napping exploded into mainstream and media consciousness in 2009, but it has a long history. One of the most notable cases occurred in not France, during the factory occupation of Sud Aviation in 1968. Workers had been holding symbolic 15-minute strikes over wage and hour cuts. There were also rumors of a plant closure or lockout. As the general strike began, workers in one section refused to return to work, marched through the factory, and convinced the rest of the workers to strike. The occupation was on, and 2,000 workers barricaded themselves inside the factory. Then a group of 20 members of management were detained over 14 days. They were treated quite well, with access to food, water, and their families. The boss napping was part of a broader, coordinated worker self-organization during the occupation. A group of 20 strikers stood guard outside in two-hour shifts, wrote one observer, and at every general meeting, a vote was taken on whether to release them or not. While the level of trade union activity was low inside the Sud Aviation before the general strike, there were organized Trotskyites who pushed for more militant action. During the action, a loudspeaker blared out the Internationale as an effective way for bosses to learn the Internationale without ideological effort. In 2013, there were several boss nappings in China. In June, workers at an American-owned specialty medical supplies in Beijing held co-owner Chip Stams hostage for 6 days. It was another well-coordinated action by the majority of workers. 80 workers barricaded every exit and ran shifts guarding Starnes. They opposed downsizing and threats to move the business to India. After 6 days, the executives caved to the workers' demands and finally signed a greatly improved compensation agreement. On June 30th, over 200 workers at the Zhangji Pile Factory in Weizhou, Guangdong province surrounded the company's office building and demanded that five visiting executives pay their withheld wages. As Han Tang reported for Labor Notes, they had not been paid for 3 months, and the bosses declared that they were going to sell the factory without the workers' permission. The workers were well organized and prevented several escape attempts. Bosses were fairly treated. On July 4th, the company announced the workers' jobs and pay would be retained in the move. China Labor Bulletin says confrontations between bosses and workers have become increasingly common. In 2014, despite laws passed to prevent it, a boss napping occurred at a Goodyear plant about 94 miles north of Paris. After a court ruling rejected the workers' appeal against the plant closure, over 100 workers occupied the plant, taking two top managers hostage for 30 hours before reaching an agreement. The workers gained 3 times the original severance pay. Unfortunately, 8 former workers received 2 years jail sentences in the boss napping. As the IWW would say, direct action gets the goods. Boss napping reportedly occurred in post-war Japan, but that is a story for another day. For The Past in the Past, I'm Harry Richardson.
Today on Madison Mixology, reporter Charlie Bielowski takes us to the golf courses of Florida and teaches us how to make a proper spiked iced tea.
Hello and welcome back to Madison Mixology. I'm your host and favorite reporter, Charlie Bielowski. Today, we're hitting the greens as I'll be teaching you how to turn the classic Arnold Palmer into a John Daly. We start with the classic Arnold Palmer, a half-and-half mix of iced tea and lemonade made popular by its namesake golfer. It was popularized in the 60s after Palmer was seen ordering the drink every time he went out golfing. Eventually, others started ordering the Arnold Palmer drink. Like all famous drinks, it was only a matter of time before somebody decided to add alcohol to the mix. The booze of choice here doesn't matter too much, but it's usually a more common base spirit like vodka. This new cocktail was made popular at the Whiskey Creek Golf Course in Fort Myers, Florida. It can be traced to 2005 at the Dirty Gator Open where Daly was participating. A bartender named Dayton Lewis was credited with its conception. Making this drink requires a simple three ingredients: lemonade, vodka, and iced tea. As per usual, you want to start with your glass of ice. From there, add 2 ounces of lemonade and 2 ounces of iced tea, or 4 ounces of any sort of lemonade iced tea mix you might have. Today I have a can of Arnold Palmer with me, so I decided to use that. After that, add about 1.5 ounces of vodka. Once you're finished with that, you have your John Daly. Let's take a sip. It's very refreshing. It's a very bright drink. I've been a fan of Arnold Palmer's for a very long time. Iced tea lemonade is one of my favorite drinks that's, you know, not water, I guess, or coffee. And the addition of the vodka gives that little warmth down your throat. And it's definitely a good drink if you are looking to loosen up on the golf course, or maybe just out and about and you want to take a little bit of the edge off. It's lighter, a lot lighter too. You can definitely tell where they were going with this. It's got a nice tint to it. It smells very refreshing. It's very nice, easy, but it's definitely a drink that you're going to want to drink colder, like ice cold. When John Daly found out that his name was being used for the drink, he was actually contemplating calling it out for trademark infringement because it was using his name and he didn't know about that. But instead, he formed the GIASI Beverage Company in 2010 with two of his close friends. He began distributing it, like, officially, and he called it the official original John Daly cocktails, and that happened in, I think, 2013. GIASI stands for Grip It and Sip It, which is a play on his catchphrase of grip it and rip it. It was originally bottled in Fairfield, California by the Franklin Distillers. The drink spread very quickly throughout the states, and as of today, 10, 11 years later, there's actually 3 different kinds of John Daly's that you can get that are pre-bottled by the GIASI Beverage Company, that being, you know, the regular iced tea lemonade, but then he's also got a peach and raspberry variant as well. Despite the drink being relatively new, there are some variants of the beverage that already exist, such as the Southern style John Daly, which actually removes the vodka and instead puts bourbon in there and adds a sprig of mint. There's also this one I really like. It's called the Juan Daly, and it's basically just the substitution of vodka for tequila, and I thought that was pretty funny. Overall, it is a very refreshing summertime drink, perfect for the golf course or relaxing at home. Try the drink for yourself, and I'll see you again next week. Reporting for WORT, I'm Charlie Bielowski, and thanks again for tuning in to another installment of Madison Mixology.
Today, feature contributor Harry Richardson reviews 2 new movies. On the big screen, Harry says Ghostbusters Frozen Empire is a worthy sequel to the Ghostbuster franchise, if a little overstuffed with characters and subplots. And on the small screen, Harry says Fry Bread Face and Me is a good slice of life movie. It follows 2 cousins and their summer on the Navajo Reservation.
For the first time in New York history, a room full of people froze to death in July.
It's an unimaginable evil with the power to kill by fear itself.
That was a clip from the trailer for Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, directed by Gil Keenan. He co-wrote the script with Jason Reitman. This was a fun, nostalgic film, but it has a few too many characters and subplots. But if you liked Ghostbusters Afterlife, I bet you'll enjoy this one too. Ghostbusters got a 44% rating from the critics on Rotten Tomatoes, but 84% from the audience. As usual, I come down closer to the audience. This film brings the whole gang to New York, where the series began, and makes fun of use of the original cast, except for Harold Ramis's Egon Spengler, who sadly passed on. We open with his daughter, single mom Callie, Carrie Coon, and her teenagers, Phoebe, McKenna Grace, and Trevor, Finn Wolfhard, riding the Ectomobile, the classic Ghostbusters hearse. Their former teacher, Callie's love interest, Gary, Paul Rudd, is driving. They're still catching ghosts. This one looks like an escapee from a Chinese New Year's celebration and causing property damage. They've moved into the old firehouse headquarters and deposit the ghosts in the classic manner. It looks like the ghost depository is full, but that is the least of their problems. Enter Ray Stantz, Dan Aykroyd, who's running a small shop testing people's objects for their ghost content and starring in a podcast series put together by podcast Logan Kim. Winston Zeddemore, Ernie Hudson, has used his fortune to finance a new lab to study ghosts and make a new containment disposal device. After their initial adventure, Phoebe is grounded by the mayor. She's only 15 and has to find other diversions. She goes out one night and meets and befriends a friendly chess-playing ghost, Emily on Lind. The ghost has failed to pass on after a fire killed the rest of her family. You get the feeling she's been floating around a long time, holding on to a single match in an old matchbook. Meanwhile, Ray has met an awkward hustler, Kumal Nanjiani, who's trying to sell off his granny's ancient artifacts. One particular item, a little spherical cryptogram, is off the charts in spirit emissions. Ray, with Phoebe and podcast in tow, riding an old motorcycle, go to consult with an ancient language expert. A great cameo by Patton Oswalt. Our expert takes us further into the depths of the library to the real books and unveils an ancient scroll that is a copy of wall carvings. He tells a tale of an evil demon captured in the sphere. He has been imprisoned for generations by the firekeeper, but the last firekeeper has passed on, or have they? A fun film worth seeing on the big screen for the nostalgia and the fine performances, especially by McKenna Grace as Phoebe. Up next, a more serious film that also highlights its youthful characters.
You go spend the summer with your grandma over on the Navajo Reyes.
You said I could go to Fleetwood Mac.
Devil music. Stevie Nicks is a witch.
And this is how my summer began.
That was clip from the trailer for Flatbread Face and Me, written and directed by Billy Luther. Luther has previously made documentaries and worked on AMC's Dark Winds, an adaptation of Tony Hillerman's crime mystery series set on the Navajo Reservation. Flatbread is a sincere, down-to-earth story where not much happens, and yet everything happens. Flatbread sort of feels like a documentary based on the director's family. Luther is from Winslow, Arizona, not far from Navajo land. The movie opens with an unseen narrator taking us back to 1993, when he's 11 years old and exiled to the reservation by his parents for the whole summer. Benny Keir Tallman is an urban kid from San Diego who's more familiar with SeaWorld, Fleetwood Mac, and action figures than rural Arizona, sheep herding, rug weaving, and bull riding. His mom, Morningstar Angeline, puts Benny on the bus and is the main recipient of his bitter complaint. You're ruining my life. Benny's dad isn't around much. Benny is soon on the sheep farm with his maternal grandmother, Sarah H. Natani, who only speaks Navajo. Benny receives a passively hostile reception from one of his uncles, Marvin Martin Sensmeyer. Thankfully, his cousin comes to stay with grandma too. Frybed Face, Charlie Hogan. She has grown up on the res, familiar with the rules and traditions. She eventually ends up translating for Benny when his grandmother has something important to say. Mostly, there are subtitles for the rest of us when grandma seeks no translator. By the end of the summer, Benny has learned a lot, and so have we. This is a fine, warm-hearted film. I highly recommend it. It recently started playing on Netflix. For WRT's Monday Movie Review, I'm Harry Richardson.
And that does it for our show. Thank you so much for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Your headline writer this evening was Nate Carlin. Special thanks to feature contributors Harry Richardson, Brenda Conkle, and Charlie Bielowski. Thanks also to Nicholas Leet for technical production and Bill Kingsbury for web production. Victor Calzoni engineered the show. Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Shelley Pittman is the news director here at WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz.
And I'm your host, Rachel Fields. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcast, Spotify, and wherever else you listen. Up next is the most freeform show on your radio dial, The Axis Hour. Have a great night.